planting his foot on the still-living enemy's belly and snapping the ash shaft in two. I had no idea who this hero was, and never did find out. "Spear!" I heard him bellow, the hellish eye sockets of his helmet spinning to the rear for relief, for a spare, for anything to call to hand. I tore both eight-footers off my back and thrust them into the unknown warrior's hands, backward. He seized one and whirled, planting it with both hands into another Mede's throat, butt spike first. His shield's grip cord had been severed or snapped from within. The aspice itself had fallen to the dirt. There was no room to retrieve it. Two Medes lunged toward the Spartan with lances leveled, only to be intercepted by the massive bowl of his rank mate's shield, dropping into place to defend him. Both enemy lances snapped as their heads drove against the bronze-facing and oak bulwark of the shield. In the rush, their momentum carried them forward, sprawling into the ground atop and tangled with the first Spartan. He drove his Xiphos into the first Mede's belly, rose with a cry of homicide, and slashed the second, hilt deep across both eyes. The enemy clutched his face in horror, blood gushing between the fingers of his clenched and clawing hands. The Spartan seized with both hands his own fallen shield and brought its rim down like an onion chopper with such force upon the enemy's throat that it nearly decapitated him. "Reform! Reform!" I heard an officer shouting. Someone shoved me aside from behind. In an instant, other Spartans from another platoon surged forward, reinforcing the membrane-thin front which teetered at the brink of buckling. This was fighting scrambled. It stopped the heart to behold the gallantry of it. In moments, what had been a situation at the brink of catastrophe was transformed by the discipline and order of the reinforcing ranks into a strong point, a fulcrum of vantage. Each man who found himself in the fore, no matter what rank he had held in formation, now assumed the role of officer. These closed ranks and lapped shields, shadow to shadow. A wall of bronze rose before the scrambled mass, buying precious instants for those who found themselves in the rear to reform and remarshal, surging into position in second, third, fourth ranks, and take on that station's role and rally to it. Nothing fires the warrior's heart more with courage than to find himself and his comrades at the point of annihilation, at the brink of being routed and overrun, and then to dredge not merely from one's own bowels or guts, but from one's own discipline and training, the presence of mind not to panic, not to yield to the possession of despair, but instead to complete those homely acts of order which Deianikes had ever declared the supreme accomplishment of the warrior. To perform the commonplace under far from commonplace conditions. Not only to achieve this for oneself alone, as Achilles or the solo champions of yore, but to do it as part of a unit, to feel about oneself one's brothers in arms, in an instance like this of chaos and disorder. Comrades whom one doesn't even know, with whom one has never trained. To feel them filling the spaces alongside him, from spear side and shield side, fore and rear, to behold one's comrades likewise rallying, not in a frenzy of mad possession-driven abandon, but with order and self-composure, each man knowing his role and rising to it, drawing strength from him as he draws it from them. The warrior in these moments finds himself lifted as if by the hand of a god. He cannot tell where his being leaves off, and that of the comrade beside him begins. In that moment, the phalanx forms a unity so dense and all-divining that it performs not merely at the level of a machine or engine of war, but surpassing that to the state of a single organism, a beast of one blood and heart. The foeman's arrows rained upon the Spartan line. From where I found myself, just behind the rear rankers, I could see the warrior's feet at first churning in disarray for purchase on the blood and gore-beslimed earth, now settle into a unison, a grinding, relentless cadence. The piper's wail pierced the din of bronze and fury, sounding the beat which was part music and part pulse of the heart. With a heave, the warrior's shield-side foot pressed forward, bows on to the enemy. Now the spear's side foot, planted at a 90-degree angle, dug into the mud. The arch sank as every stone of the man's weight found purchase upon the insole, and with left shoulder planted into the inner bowl of the shield, whose broad outer surface was pressed into the back of the comrade before him, he summoned all force of tissue and tendon to surge and heave upon the beat. Like ranked oarsmen straining upon the shaft of a single oar, the unified push of the men's exertions propelled the ship of the phalanx forward into the tide of the enemy. Up front, the eight-footers of the Spartans thrust downward upon the foe, driven by each man's spear arm in an overhand strike across the upper rim of his shield toward the enemy's face, throat, and shoulders. The sound of shield against shield was no longer the clash and clang of initial impact, but deeper and more terrifying, a grinding metallic mechanism like the jaws of some unholy mill of murder. Nor did the men's cries, Spartans and Medes, rise any longer in the mad chorus of rage and terror. Instead, each warrior's lungs pumped only for breath. Chests heaved like foundry bellows. Sweat coursed onto the ground in runnels, while the sound which arose from the throats of the contending masses was like nothing so much as a myriad quarrymen, each harnessed to the twined rope of the sled, groaning and straining to drag some massive stone across the resisting earth. War is work, Deianakes had always taught, seeking to strip it of its mystery. The Medes, for all their valor, all their numbers, and all the skill they doubtless possessed in the type of open plain warfare with which they had conquered all Asia, had not served their apprenticeship in this Hellene-style heavy infantry combat. Their files had not trained to hold line of thrust and gather themselves to heave in unison. The ranks had not drilled endlessly as the Spartans had in maintaining dress and interval, cover and shadow. Amid the manslaughter, the Medes became a mob. They shoved at the Lacedaemonians like sheep fleeing a fire in a shearing pen, without cadence or cohesion, fueled only by courage which, glorious though it was, could not prevail against the disciplined and cohesive assault which now pressed upon them. The luckless foemen in front had nowhere to hide. They found themselves pinned between the mob of their own fellows, trampling them from behind, and the Spartan spears plunging upon them from the fore. Men expired simply from want of breath. Their hearts gave out under the extremity. I glimpsed Alpheus and Maron. Like a pair of yoked oxen, the brothers, fighting shoulder to shoulder, formed the tempered steel point of a 12-deep thrust that drove into and split the Median ranks 100 feet out from the mountain wall. The knights to the twins' right drove into this breach with Leonidas fighting in the van. They turned the enemy line into a flank and pressed furiously upon the foeman's unshielded right. God help the sons of the empire, seeking to stand against these, Polyneikes and Dorion, Terclius and Patroclus, Nicolaus and the two Aegisces, all matchless athletes in the prime of young manhood, fighting alongside their king and mad to seize the glory that now quavered within their grasp. For myself, I confess the horror of it nearly overcame me. Though I had loaded up double with 2 packed quivers, 24 iron heads, the demands of fire had come so fierce and furious that I was down to nothing before I could spit. I was firing between the helmets of the warriors, point-blank into the faces and throats of the foe. This was not archery, it was slaughter. I was pulling iron heads from the bowels of still-living men to reload and replenish my spent stock. The ash of a shaft drawn across my bow-hand slipped from its notch, slimy with gore and tissue. Warheads dripped blood before they were even fired. Overwhelmed by horror, my eyes clamped shut of their own will. I had to tear at my face with both hands to drive them open. Had I gone mad? I was desperate to find Deianakes, to get to my station covering him, but the part of my mind which still owned its wits ordered me to rally myself here, contribute here. In the crush of the phalanx, each man could sense the sea change as the rush of emergency passed like a wave, replaced by the steadying, settling sensation of fear passing over, composure returning and the drill settling to the murderous work of war. Who can say by what unspoken timbre the tidal flow of the fight is communicated within the massed ranks? Somehow, the warriors sensed that the Spartan left along the mountain face had broken the Medes. A cheer swept laterally like a storm front, rising and multiplying from the throats of the Lacedaemonians. The enemy knew it too. They could feel their line caving in. Now, at last, I found my master. With a cry of joy, I spotted his cross-crested officer's helmet in the fore, pressing murderously upon a knot of Median lancers who no longer offered attack, but only stumbled rearward in terror, casting away their shields as they fouled upon the desperate press of men behind them. I sprinted toward his position, across the open space, immediately to the rear of the grinding, gnashing, advancing Spartan line. The strip of hinter ground comprised the only corridor of haven upon the entire field. In the overshot gap between the hand-to-hand slaughter of the line and the beaten zone of the Median archers' arrows, which they flung from the rear of their own lines over the clashing armies toward the Hellenic formations waiting in reserve. The Median wounded had dragged themselves into this pocket of sanctuary, they and the terror-stricken, the possum players and the exhausted. Enemy bodies were everywhere, the dead and the dying, the trampled and the overrun, the maimed and the massacred. I saw a Mede with a magnificent beard sitting sheepishly upon the ground, cradling his intestines in his hands. As I dashed past, one of his own kinsmen's arrows rained from above, nailing his thigh to the turf. His eyes met mine with the most piteous expression. I don't know why, but I dragged him a half-dozen strides into the mainland of the pocket of illusory safety. I looked behind. The Tegeates and the Opuntian Locrians, our allies next up into the fray, knelt in their ranks, massed along the line below Lionstone, with their shields interleaved and elevated to deflect the deluge of enemy shafts. The expanse of earth before them bristled like a pincushion, as dense with enemy arrows as the quills of a hedgehog's spine. The palisade of the wall was afire, blazing with the tow-bolts of the enemy by the hundred. Now the Median lancers cracked, like a child's game of bowls, their stacked files toppled rearward, bodies fell and tumbled upon one another as those in the fore attempted to flee and those in the rear became entangled pell-mell with their flight. The ground before the Spartan advance became a sea of limbs and torsos, trousered thighs and bellies, the backs of men crawling hand over hand across their fallen comrades, while others, pinned upon their backs, writhed and cried out in their tongue, hands upraised, pleading for quarter. The slaughter surpassed the mind's capacity to assimilate it. I saw Olympias thrashing rearward, treading not upon ground but upon the flesh of the fallen foe, across a carpet of bodies, the wounded as well as the dead, while his squire, Abatus, flanked him, sinking his lizard sticker, punching the spiked shaft downward like a boatman poling a punt into the bellies of the yet unslain enemy as they passed. Olympias advanced into plain view of the allied reserves in position along the wall. He stripped his helmet so the commanders could see his face, then pumped thrice with his horizontally held spear. "Advance! Advance!" With a cry that curdled the blood, they did. I saw Olympias pause bareheaded and stare at the foe-strewn earth about him, himself overcome by the scale of the carnage. Then he reseated his helmet. His face vanished beneath the blood-blasted bronze, and, summoning his squire, he strode back to the slaughter. To the rear of the routed lancers stood their brothers, the Median archers. These were drawn up in still-ordered ranks, 20 deep, each bowman in station behind a body-height shield of wicker, its base anchored to the earth with spikes of iron. A no-man's land of 100 feet separated the Spartans from this wall of bowmen. The foe now began firing directly into their own lancers, the last pockets of the valiant who yet grappled with the Lacedaemonian advance. The Medes were shooting their own men in the back. They didn't care if they slew 10 of their brothers, if one lucky bolt could nail a Spartan. Of all the moments of supreme valor which unfolded throughout this long, grisly day, that which the allies upon the wall now beheld surpassed all, nor could any who witnessed it place any sight beneath heaven alongside it as equal. As the Spartan front routed the last remaining lancers, its four-rankers emerged into the open, exposed to what was now the nearly point-blank fire of the Median archers. Leonidas himself, at his age, having survived a melee of murder whose physical expenditure alone would have pressed beyond the limits of endurance even the stoutest youth in his prime, yet summoned the steel to stride to the fore, shouting the order to form up in advance. This command the Lacedaemonians obeyed, if not with the precision of the parade ground, then with a discipline and order beyond imagining under the circumstances. Before the Medes had time to loose their second broadside, they found themselves face to face with a front of 60-plus shields, the lambdas of Lacedaemon obscured beneath horrific layers of mud, gore, and blood, which ran in rivers down the bronze and dripped from the leather aprons pended beneath the aspides, the oxhide skirts which protected the warriors' legs from precisely the fusillade into which they now advanced. Heavy bronze greaves defended the calves. Above each shield rim extended only the armored crowns of the helmets, eye-slits alone exposed, while overtopping these waved the front-to-back horsehair plumes of the warriors and the transverse crests of the officers. The wall of bronze and crimson advanced into the Median fire. Cane arrows ripped with murderous velocity into the Spartan lines. Possessed by terror, an archer will always shoot high. You could hear these overshot shafts hailing and clattering as they ripped at crown height past the Spartan foreranks and tore into the forest of spears held at the vertical. Then the missiles tumbled, spent, among the armored ranks. Bronze-head bolts caromed off bronze-faced shields with a sound like a hammer on an anvil, their furious drumming punctuated by the concussive thwack of a dead-on shot penetrating metal and oak so the head lanced through the shield like a nail piercing a board. I myself had planted shoulder and spine into the back of Medon, senior of the Deucalion mess, whose station of honor stood rearmost of the first file in Dionyces' platoon. The pipers were hunkered immediately in the lee of the formation, unarmed and unarmored, crouching for cover as close to the heels of the rear rankers as they could without tripping them, all the while summoning breath to skirl out the shrill Aulos's beat. The densely packed ranks advanced, not in a mobbed, disordered charge, shouting like savages, but dead silent, sober, almost stately, with a dread deliberateness in time to the piper's keening wail. Between the fighting fronts, the 100-foot gap had narrowed to 60. Now the Medes' fire redoubled. You could hear the orders bawled by their officers and feel the air itself vibrate as the ranks of the foe loosed their fusillades in ever more furious succession. A single arrow, blazing past one's ear, can turn the knees to jelly. The honed warhead seems to scream with malevolence, the hurtling weight of the shaft driving its death-dealing cargo. Then come the fletched feathers, communicating by their silent shriek the homicidal intent of the enemy. 100 arrows make a different sound. Now the air seems to thicken, to become dense, incandescent. It vibrates like a solid. The warrior feels encapsulated as in a corridor of living steel. Reality shrinks to the zone of murder in which he finds himself imprisoned. The sky itself cannot be glimpsed nor even remembered. Now come 1,000 arrows. The sound is like a wall. There is no space within, no interval of haven. Solid as a mountain, impenetrable, it sings with death. And when those arrows are launched, not skyward, in long-range, arcing trajectory, to beat upon the target driven by the weight of their own fall, but instead are fired point-blank, dead flush from the shoot of the bowman's grip, so that their flight is level, flat, loosed at such velocity and at such close range that the archer does not trouble even to calculate drop into his targeting equation, this is the rain of iron. Hellfire at its purest. Into this the Spartans advanced. They were told later by the Allies observing from the wall that at this instant, as the spears of the Spartans' front ranks lowered in unison from the vertical plane of advance into the leveled position of attack, and the serried phalanx lengthened stride to assault the foe at the double, at this moment His Majesty, looking on, had leaped to his feet in terror for his army. The Spartans knew how to attack Wicker. They had practiced against it beneath the oaks on the field of Otona, in the countless repetitions when we squires and helots took station with practice shields, planted our heels, and braced with all our strength, awaiting the massed shock of their assault. The Spartans knew the spear was worthless against the interlatticed staves. Its shaft penetrated the wicker only to become imprisoned and impossible to extract. Likewise, the thrust or slash of the xiphos, which caromed off as if striking iron. The enemy line must be struck shock troop style, and overwhelmed, bowled over. It had to be hit so hard, and with such concentrated force, that its front rankers caved and toppled, one rank backward upon another like plateware in a cabinet when the earth quakes. This is precisely what happened. The Median archers were drawn up not in a massed square front to back, with each warrior reinforcing his comrades against the shock of assault, but honeycombed in alternating fronts, each rank at the shoulder of the one before it, so that the bowmen in the second could fire in the gaps left by the first, and on in this fashion rearward throughout the formation. Moreover, the enemy ranks were not stacked with the massed compaction of the Spartan phalanx. There was a void, an interval between ranks dictated by the physical demands of the bow. The result of this was precisely what the Lacedaemonians expected. The forerank of the enemy collapsed immediately as the first shock hit it. The body-length shields seemed to implode rearward, their anchoring spikes rooted, slinging from the earth like tent pins in a gale. The forerank archers were literally bowled off their feet, their wall-like shields caving in upon them like fortress redoubts under the assault of the ram. The Spartan advance ran right over them, and the second rank and the third. The mob of enemy mid-rankers, urged on by their officers, sought desperately to dig in and hold. Closed breast to breast with the Spartan shock troops, the foe's bows were useless. They flung them aside, fighting with their belt scimitars. I saw an entire front of them, shieldless, slashing wildly with a blade in each hand. The valor of individual Medes was beyond question, but their light hacking blades were harmless as toys. Against the massed wall of Spartan armor, they might as well have been defending themselves with reeds or fennel stalks. We learned that evening, from Hellenic deserters who had fled in the confusion, that the foe's rearmost ranks, 30 and 40 back from the front, had been pressed rearward so resistlessly by the collapse of the men up front that they began tumbling off the Trachinian track into the sea. Pandemonium had apparently reigned along a section several hundred yards long, beyond the narrows, where the trail ran flush against the mountain wall, with the gulf yawning 80 feet below. Over this brink, the deserters reported, hapless lancers and archers had toppled by the score, clinging to the men before them, and pulling these down with them to their deaths. His Majesty, we heard, was forced to witness this, as his vantage lay almost directly above the sight. This was the second moment, so the observers reported, when His Majesty sprung to his feet in dread for the fate of his warriors. The ground immediately to the rear of the Spartan advance, as expected, was littered with the trampled forms of the enemy dead and wounded. But there was a new wrinkle. The Medes had been overrun with such speed and force that numbers of them, far from inconsiderable, had survived intact. These now rose and attempted to rally, only to find themselves assaulted almost at once by the massed ranks of the allied reserves, who were already advancing in formation to reinforce and relieve the Spartans. A second slaughter now ensued, as the Tegeates and Opuntian Locrians fell upon this yet unreaped harvest. Tegea lies immediately adjacent to the territory of Lacedaemon. For centuries the Spartans and Tegeates had battled over the border plains before, in the previous three generations, becoming fast allies and comrades. Of all the Peloponnesians save the Spartans, the warriors of Tegea are the fiercest and most skilled. As for the Locrians of Opus, this was their country they were fighting for. Their homes and temples, fields and sanctuaries lay within an hour's march of the hot gates. Quarter, they knew, stood not within the invaders' lexicon. Neither would it be found in theirs. I was dragging a wounded knight, Polynices's friend Dorion, to the safety of the field's shoulder when my foot slipped in an ankle-deep stream. Twice I tried to regain balance and twice fell. I was cursing the earth. What perverse spring had suddenly burst forth from the mountainside when none had shown itself in this place before? I looked down. A river of blood covered both feet, draining across a gouge in the dirt like the gutter of an abattoir. The Medes had cracked. The Tegeates and Opuntian Locrians surged in reinforcement through the ranks of the spent Spartans, pressing the assault upon the reeling enemy. It was the allies' turn now. "Put the steel to 'em, boys," one among the Spartans cried, as the wave of allied ranks advanced 10 deep from the rear and both flanks and closed into a massed phalanx before the warriors of Sparta, who at last drew up, limbs quaking with fatigue, and collapsed against one another and upon the earth. At last I found my master. He was on one knee, shattered with exhaustion, clinging with both fists to his shivered blade-bereft spear, which was driven butt-spike first into the earth, and from which he hung like a broken marionette upon a stick. The weight of his helmet bore his head groundward. He possessed strength neither to lift it nor to pull it off. Alexandros collapsed beside him on all fours, with the crown of his helmet, crest first, mashed with exhaustion into the dirt. His ribcage heaved like a hound's, while spittle, phlegm, and blood dripped from the bronze of his cheekpieces in a frothing lather. Here came the Tegeates and Locrians surging past us. There they went, driving the enemy before them. For the first interval in what seemed an eternity, the dread of imminent extinction lifted. The Lacedaemonians dropped to the earth where they stood, on knees first, then knees and elbows, then simply sprawling, on sides and on backs, collapsing against one another, sucking breath in gasping, labored need. Eyes stared vacantly as if blind. None could summon strength to speak. Weapons drooped of their own weight in fists so cramped that the will could not compel the muscles to release their frozen grasp. Shields toppled to earth, bowled down and defamed. Exhausted men collapsed into them, face first, and could not find strength even to turn their faces to the side to breathe. A fistful of teeth spit from Alexandros's mouth. When he recovered strength sufficient to prise his helmet off, his long hair came out at the roots, in wads, a tangled mass of salt, sweat, and matted blood. His eyes stared, blank as stones. He collapsed like a child, burying his face in my master's lap, weeping the dry tears of those whose shattered substance has no more fluid to spend. Suicide came up, shot through both shoulders and oblivious with elation. He stood above the collapsed ranks of men, fearless, peering out to where the Allies had now closed with the last of the Medes and were hacking them to pieces with such a grisly din that it seemed the slaughter was taking place 10 paces away instead of 100. I could see my master's eyes, pools of black behind the hooded eye slits of his helmet. His hand gestured feebly to the empty spear sheath across my back. "What happened to my spares?" His throat croaked hoarsely. "I gave them away." A moment passed while he waited for breath. "To our own men, I hope." I helped him off with his helmet. It seemed to take minutes, so swollen with sweat and blood was his felt undercap and the tangled, clotted mass of his hair. The water-bearers had arrived. None among the warriors possessed the strength even to cup his hands. So the liquid was simply splashed upon rags and blouses which the men pressed to their lips and sucked. Dionyces swabbed the tangled hair off his face. His left eye was gone, sliced through, leaving a ghoulish socket of tissue and blood. "I know," was all he said. Aristomenes and Bias and others of the platoon, Black Leon and Leon Dunkydick, now surfaced into view, gasping upon the earth, their arms and legs sliced and lacerated with innumerable slashes, glistening with mud and blood. They and other scrambled men from other scrambled units lay heaped upon one another like a frieze on a temple wall. I knelt now at my master's side, pressing the water rag as a compress into the hollow where his eye had been. The fabric welled with fluid like a sponge. Out front, where the enemy was falling back in wild disorder, the victors of the moment could see Polyneikes on his feet, alone, with his arms raised toward the fleeing foe. He wrenched his helmet from his skull, dripping blood and sweat, and flung it in triumph upon the earth. "Not today, you sons of whores," he bellowed at the foe in flight. "Not today." Chapter 25. I cannot state with certainty how many times on that first day each allied contingent took its turn upon the triangle bounded by the narrows and the mountain face, the sea cliffs and the Phocian wall. I can declare with conviction only that my master went through 4 shields, 2 whose oak underchassis were shattered by repeated blows, 1 whose bronze plexus was staved in, and a 4th whose grip cord and forearm sheath were ripped right out of their sockets. Replacements were not hard to find. One had only to stoop. So many were the discards littered upon the field, with their owners dead and dying beside them. Of the 16 in my master's Enomotia were slain on that first day Lampitos, Soobiades, Telamon, Scythlenolides, Ariston, and grievously wounded, Nicandros, Myron, Carolyn, and Bias. Ariston fell in the 4th and final siege, that against His Majesty's immortals. Ariston was that youth of 20 years, one of Polyneikes's broken noses, whose sister Agathe had been given as a bride to Alexandros. That made them brothers-in-law. The retrieval party found Ariston's body around midnight, along the mountain wall. His squire, Demades's form, lay sprawled atop Ariston's, with his shield still in place, seeking to protect his master, both of whose shins had been shattered by the blows of a Sagaris battle-axe. The shaft of an enemy lance was broken off just beneath Demades's left nipple. Although Ariston had sustained more than 20 wounds upon his own body, it was a single blow to the head, apparently delivered with some kind of mace or battle sledge, which had ultimately slain him, crushing both helmet and skull directly above the eyeline. The tickets of the dead were customarily held and distributed by the chief battle priest, in this case Alexandros's father, the polemarch Olympius. He himself had been killed, however, slain by a Persian arrow an hour before nightfall, just prior to the final clash with the Persian immortals. Olympias had taken shelter with his men on the rampart of the wall, in the lee of the palisade, preparatory to arming himself for the day's final siege. Of all things, he was writing in his journal. The unburned timbers of the palisade protected him, he thought. He had stripped helmet and cuirass. But the arrow, guided by some perverse fate, pierced the single opening available to it, a space no wider than a man's hand. It struck Olympias in the cervical spine, severing the spinal cord. He died, minutes later, without regaining speech or consciousness, in his son's arms. With that, Alexandros had lost father and brother-in-law in a single afternoon. Among the Spartans, the most grievous casualties of the first day were suffered by the knights. Of 30, 17 were either killed or incapacitated too severely to fight. Leonidas was wounded 6 times, but walked off the field under his own power. Astonishingly, Polyneikes, fighting all day in the forefront of the bloodiest action, had sustained no more than the slashes and lacerations incidental to action, a number of them doubtless inflicted by his own errant steel and that of his mates. He had, however, severely strained both hamstrings and pulled his left shoulder simply from exertion and the excessive demands made upon the flesh in moments of supreme necessity. His squire, Acanthus, had been killed defending him, lucklessly like Olympias, just minutes before the cessation of the day's slaughter. The second attack had commenced at noon. These were the mountain warriors of Sicyon. None among the allies even knew where the hell this place was, but wherever it was, it bred men of ungodly valor. Sicyon, the allies learned later, is a country of stern and hostile highlands not far from Babylon, dense with ravines and defiles. This contingent of the enemy, far from being daunted by the cliff wall of Calydromus, took this obstacle in stride, clambering up and along its face, rolling stones down indiscriminately upon their own troops as well as the allies. I myself could not view this struggle directly, being stationed during that interval behind the wall, all efforts consumed with tending my master's wounds and those of our platoon, and looking to their and my own necessaries. But I could hear it. It sounded like the whole mountain coming down. At one point, from where Deianakes and Alexandros were, in the Spartan camp, 100 feet rearward of the wall, we could see the ready platoons, in this rotation, the Mantinean and the Arcadians, pouring up to the battlements of the wall, and there hurling javelins, spears, and even dismantled boulders down upon the attackers, who, in the elation of the triumph they thought at hand, were keening a blood-curdling wail, which I can only replicate as, The Thebans, we learned that evening, were the ones who threw back the Sicyon assault. These warriors of Thebes held the right flank, as the allies saw it, alongside the sea cliffs. Their commander, Leontiades, and the picked champions fighting alongside him managed to secure a breach in the mob of the enemy about 40 feet out from the cliffs. The Thebans poured into this break and began shoving the cut-off ranks of the foe about 20 files in breadth toward the cliffs. Again, the weight of the allied armor proved irresistible. The enemy right were rooted backward by the press of their own failing comrades. They toppled into the sea, as before in the rout of the Medes, clutching at the trousers, sword belts, and finally the ankles of their fellows, pulling them over with them. The scale and celerity of the slaughter had clearly been massive, made more so by the ghastly manner in which the slain perished, that is, tumbling 80 and 100 feet to have their bodies broken upon the rocks below, or, escaping that, to drown in armor in the sea. Even from our position, an 1/8 of a mile away, and above the din of battle, we could hear plainly the cries of the falling men. The Saeci were the next nation elected by Xerxes to assault the allies. These massed below the narrows around mid-afternoon. They were plainsmen and mountain men, warriors of the Eastern Empire, and the bravest of all the troops the allies faced. They fought with battle axes and inflicted for a time the most grisly casualties upon the Greeks. Yet in the end, their own courage was their undoing. They did not break or panic. They simply came on, in wave after wave, clawing over the fallen bodies of their brothers, to hurl themselves as if seeking their own slaughter upon the shields and iron spear points of the Greeks. Against these Saeci were arrayed at first the Mycenaeans, the Corinthians, and the Phlians, with the Spartans, Tegeates, and Thespians in ready reserve. These last were flung into battle almost at once, as the Mycenaeans and Corinthians spent themselves in the mill of murder and became too exhausted to continue. The reserves likewise became shattered with fatigue, and themselves had to be relieved by the third rotation of Orchomenians, and other Arcadians, these last having barely gotten out of the previous melee and had time to gnaw a hard biscuit and gulp down a snootful of wine. By the time the Saeci broke, the sun was well over the mountain. The dance floor, now in full shadow, looked like a field ploughed by the oxen of hell. Not an inch remained unchurned and unriven. The rock-hard earth, sodden now with blood and piss and the unholy fluids which had spilled from the entrails of the slain and the butchered, lay churned in places to the depth of a man's calf. There is a spring, sacred to Persephone, behind the sallyport adjacent to the Lacedaemonian camp, where in the morning, immediately following the repulsion of the Median assault, the Spartans and Thespians had collapsed in exhaustion and triumph. In that initial instant of salvation, however temporary, all knew it must be, a flush of supreme joy had flooded over the entire allied camp. Panoplied men faced one another and slammed shields together, just for the joy of it, like boys, rejoicing in the clamor of bronze upon bronze. I saw two warriors of the Arcadians standing face to face, pounding each other with fists upon the shoulders of their leathers, tears of joy streaming down their faces. Others whooped and danced. One warrior of the Phlians grasped the corner of the redoubt with both hands and pounded his helmeted brow against the stone, bang, 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 like a lunatic. Others writhed upon the ground, as horses will do sand-bathing, so overflushed with joy that they could discharge its excess in no other way. Simultaneously, a second wave of emotion coursed through the camp. This was of piety. Men embraced one another, weeping in awe before the gods. Prayers of thanksgiving were sung from fervent hearts, and none took shame to voice them. Across the expanse of the camp, one saw knots of warriors kneeling in invocation, circles of a dozen with clasped hands, knots of three and four with arms around each other's shoulders, pairs crouching knee to knee, and everywhere individuals upon the earth in prayer. Now 7 hours into the slaughter, all such observance of piety had fled. Men stared with hollow eyes upon the riven plain. Across this farmer's field of death lay sown such a crop of corpses and shields, hacked up armor and shattered weapons, that the mind could not assimilate its scale, nor the senses give it compass. The wounded, in numbers uncountable, groaned and cried out, writhing amid piles of limbs and severed body parts, so intertangled one could not distinguish individual men, but the whole seemed a gorgon-like beast of 10,000 limbs, some ghastly monster spawned by the cloven earth and now draining itself, fluid by fluid, back into that chthonic cleft which had given it birth. Along the face of the mountain the stone glistened scarlet to the height of a man's knee. The faces of the allied warriors had by this hour clotted into featureless masks of death. Blank eyes stared from sunken sockets as if the divine force, the daimon, had been extinguished like a lamp, replaced by a weariness beyond description. A stare without affect, the hollow gaze of hell itself. I turned to Alexandros. He looked 50 years old. In the mirror of his eyes I beheld my own face, and could no longer recognize it. A temper toward the enemy now arose which had not been present before. This was not hatred, but rather a refusal to reckon quarter. A reign of savagery began. Acts of barbarity which had been hitherto unthinkable now presented themselves to the mind and were embraced without a quibble. The theatre of war, the stink and spectacle of carnage on such a scale, had so overwhelmed the senses with horror that the mind had grown numb and insensate. With perverse wit, it actually sought these, and sought to intensify them. All knew that the next attack would be the day's last. Nightfall's curtain would adjourn the slaughter until tomorrow. It was also clear that whichever force the foe next threw into the line would be his finest. The cream saved for this hour when the Hellenes labored in exhaustion and stood the likeliest chance of being overthrown by fresh troops. Leonidas, who had not slept now in more than 40 hours, yet prowled the lines of defenders, assembling each allied unit and addressing it in person. "Remember, brothers, the final fight is everything. All we have achieved so far this day is lost, if we do not prevail now at the end. Fight as you have never fought before." In the intervals between the first three assaults, each warrior, readying for the next engagement, had striven to scour clean the face of his shield and helmet, to present again to the foe the gleaming, terror-inspiring surface of bronze. As the threshing mill of murder progressed throughout the day, however, this housekeeping became honored increasingly in the breach, as each knurl and inlay on the shield acquired a grisly encrustment of blood and dirt, mud and excrement, fragments of tissue, flesh, hair, and gore of every description. Besides, the men were too tired. They didn't care any more. Now Dithyrambus, the Thespian captain, sought to make a virtue of necessity. He ordered his men to cease from burnishing their shields, and instead to paint and streak them and the men's own body armor with yet more blood and gore. This Dithyrambus, by trade an architect and by no means a professional soldier, had already distinguished himself with such magnificent courage throughout the day that the prize of valor, it was a foregone conclusion, would be his by acclamation. His gallantry had elevated him second only to Leonidas in prestige among the men. Dithyrambus now, stationing himself in the open in full view of all the men, proceeded to smear his own shield, which was already nearly black with dried blood, with yet more gore and guts and fresh, dripping fluid. The allies in line, the Thespians, Tegeates, and Mantineans, ghoulishly followed suit. The Spartans alone abstained, not out of delicacy or decorum, but simply in obedience to their own laws of campaign, which command them to adhere without alteration to their customary disciplines and practices of arms. Dithyrambus now ordered the squires and servants to hold their places, to refrain from sweeping the advance ground of enemy bodies. Instead, he sent his own men out onto the arena with orders to heap the corpses in display in the most ghoulish manner possible, so as to present to the next wave of the foe, whose marshalling trumpets could already be heard around the shoulder of the Narrows, the most ghastly and terrifying spectacle possible. "Brothers and allies, my own beautiful dogs from hell," he addressed the warriors, striding helmetless before the lines, his voice carrying powerfully even to those upon the wall and marshalling in the ready ground behind. "This next wave will be the day's last. Cinch up your balls, men, for one final surpassing effort. The enemy believes us exhausted and anticipates dispatching us to the underworld beneath his onslaught of fresh, rested troops. What he doesn't know is we're already there. We crossed the line hours ago." He gestured to the Narrows and its carpeting of horror. "We stand already in hell. It is our home." A cheer rose from the line, overtopped by wild, profane shouts and whoops of hellish laughter. "Remember, men," Dithyrambus's voice rose yet more powerfully, "that this next wave of Asiatic ass-fuckers has not seen us yet. Consider what they have seen. They know only that three of their mightiest nations have advanced against us wearing their testicles and come back without them. And I promise you they are not fresh. They've been sitting on their dog blossoms all day, watching their allies carried and dragged back, hacked to pieces by us. Believe me, their imaginations have not been idle. Each man has conjured his own head cleaved at the neck, his own guts spilling into the dirt, and his own cock and balls brandished before him on the point of a Greek spear. We're not the ones who are worn out, they are. Fresh shouting and tumult erupted from the allies, save the Spartans, while the Thespians on the field continued their butchery. I glanced to Deianakes, who observed this all with a grim twist upon his features. "By the gods," he declared, "it's getting ugly out there." We could see the Spartan knights, led by Polyneikes and Dorion, taking their stations about Leonidas in the forefront of the line. Now a lookout came running back in from the forwardmost post. This was Hound, the Spartan Scyrite. He sprinted straight to Leonidas and made his report. The news spread swiftly. The next wave would be Xerxes' own household guard, the Immortals. The Greeks knew that these comprised His Majesty's picked champions, the flower of Persian nobility, princes schooled from birth to draw the bow and speak the truth. More to the point, their numbers were 10,000, while the Greeks had fewer than 3,000 still fit to fight. The Immortals, all knew, derived their name from the custom of the Persians that replaced at once each royal guardsman who died or retired, thus keeping the number of Xerxes' finest always at 10,000. This corps of champions now advanced into view at the neck of the Narrows. They wore not helmets, but tiaras, soft felt caps topped with skull crowns of metal glistening like gold. These half-helmets possessed no cover for the ears, neck, or jaw, and left the face and throat entirely exposed. The warriors wore earrings. Some of their faces were painted with eye kohl and rouged, like women. Nonetheless, they were magnificent specimens, selected, it seemed, not merely, as the Hellenes well knew, for valor and nobility of family, but for height and handsomeness of person as well. Each man looked more dashing than the fellow at his shoulder. They wore sleeved tunics of silk, purple rimmed with scarlet, protected by a sleeveless coat of mail in the shape of fish scales, and trousers atop calf-height doe-skin boots. Their weapons were the bow, belt scimitar, and short Persian lance, and their shields, like the Medes and the Scythians, were shoulder-to-groiners made of wicker. Most astonishing of all, however, was the quantity of gold ornament each immortal wore upon his person in the form of brooches and bracelets, amulets and adornments. Their commander, Hydarnes, advanced to the fore, the only mounted antagonist the allies had so far beheld. His tiara was peaked like a monarch's crown, and his eyes shone brilliantly beneath cold lashes. His horse was spooking, refusing to advance across the charnel sward of corpses. The foe drew up in ranks on the flat beyond the Narrows. Their discipline was impeccable. They were spotless. Leonidas now strode forth to address the allies. He confirmed what each Hellenic warrior presumed by sight, that the division of the enemy now advancing into view was indeed Xerxes' own immortals, and that the number of their company, as nearly as could be estimated by eye, was the full 10,000. "It would appear, gentlemen," Leonidas's voice ascended powerfully, "that the prospect of facing the picked champions of all Asia should daunt us. But I swear to you, this battle will prove the most dustless of all." The king used the Greek word akoniti, whose application is customarily to wrestling, boxing, and the pancration. When a victor overthrows his opponent so swiftly that the bout fails even to raise the dust of the arena, he is said to have triumphed akoniti, in a no-duster. "Listen," Leonidas proceeded, "and I will tell you why. The troops Xerxes throws at us now are for the first time of actual Persian blood. Their commanders are the king's own kinsmen. He has brothers out there, and cousins, and uncles, and lovers, officers of his own line whose lives are precious to him beyond price. Do you see him up there upon his throne? The nations he has sent against us so far have been mere vassal states, spear fodder to such a despot who squanders their lives without counting the cost. These," Leonidas gestured across the Narrows to the space where Hydarnes and the Immortals now marshaled, These he treasures. These he loves. Their murder he will feel like an 8-footer in the guts. Remember that this battle at the Hot Gates is not the one Xerxes came here to fight. He anticipates far more momentous struggles to come in the heartland of Hellas against the main force of our armies, and for these clashes he wishes to preserve the flower of his army, the men you see before you now. He will be frugal with their lives today, I promise you. As to their numbers, they are 10,000, we are 4. But each man we slay will sting like a regiment to their king. These warriors are to him like miser's gold, which he hoards and covets beyond all else in his treasury. Kill 1,000, and the rest will crack. 1,000, and their master will pull the remainder out. Can you do that for me, men? Can 4 of you kill 1 of them? Can you give me 1,000? Chapter 26. His Majesty himself may best judge the precision of Leonidas's forecast. Suffice it to note, for this record, that darkness found the immortals in shattered retreat. Under his Majesty's orders, as Leonidas had predicted, leaving the broken and dying upon the orchestra, the dance floor of the Narrows. Behind the allied wall, the spectacle was one of corresponding horror. A downpour had drenched the camp shortly after nightfall, drowning what few fires remained, with none to tend them, all effort of squires, attendants, and mates being required to succor the wounded and the maimed. Slides toppled from the wall of Calydromus, sluicing the upper camp with rivers of mud and stone. Across this sodden expanse, slain and spared, sprawled limb upon limb, many still in armor, the slumber of the exhausted so profound that one could not distinguish the living from the dead. Everything was soaked and muck begrimed. Stores of dressings for the wounded had long since been depleted. The spa-goers' tents, requisitioned by the Skiritai rangers as shelter, now found their linen called to duty a second time as battle compresses. The stink of blood and death rose with such palpable horror that the asses of the supply train bawled all night and could not be quietened. There was a third unrostered member of the allied contingent. A volunteer other than the outlaw ball player and the roan bitch Styx. This was an emporos, a merchant of Miletus, Elephantinos by name, whose disabled wagon the allied column had chanced upon during its march through Doris a day prior to arrival at the gates. This fellow, despite his misfortune of the road, maintained the merriest of spirits, sharing a lunch of green apples with his hobbled ass. Upon the brow of his wagon rose a hand-painted standard, an advertisement, as it were, of his congeniality and eagerness of custom. The sign intended to declare, "The best service only for you, my friend." The tinker had misspelled, however, several words, chiefly friend. Philos, which his hand had inscribed, phimos, the term in Doric for a contraction of the flesh which covers the male member. The wagon's banner declared roughly thus, "The best service only for you, my foreskin." The luster of this poesy rendered the fellow an instant celebrity. Several squires were detached to assist him, for which courtesy the tradesman expressed abounding gratitude. "And where, if one may inquire, is this magnificent army bound?" "To die for Hellas," someone answered. "How delightful!" Toward midnight the tinker appeared in camp, having tracked the column all the way to the gates. He was welcomed with enthusiasm. His specialty lay in applying an edge to steel, and at this, he testified, he stood without peer. He had been sharpening farmers' scythes and housewives' cleavers for decades. He knew how to make even the meanest untempered trowel hold an edge, and moreover, he vowed, he would donate his services to the army in repayment of their kindness upon the highway. The fellow employed an expression with which he spiked his conversation whenever he wished to emphasize a point. "Wake up to this," he would say, though in his dense Ionian accent it came out as, "Wake up to this." This phrase was immediately and with high glee adopted by the entire army. "Cheese and onions again, wake up to this. Double drill all day, wake up to this." One of the two Leons in Dianakes' platoon, Donkey Dick, rousted the merchant that succeeding dawn by brandishing before his slumber-dazed eyes a prodigious erection. "They call this a phimos. Wake up to this." The tradesman became a kind of mascot or talisman to the troops.